All right, so tonight we're on idolatry. To read our passage in Galatians, we're studying the works of the flesh. Remember, the word flesh doesn't mean our physical body. It thinks in terms of what our mind can contemplate about things. It's not always about the body. And it definitely doesn't mean that in Scripture. In Romans, Paul has a statement that says, those who are in the flesh cannot please God. Well, if he meant the physical body, then we couldn't please God in this body, but we know we can because the Bible says by faith we please Him in Hebrews 11. So it's not talking about the body, it's talking about a mindset that's wedded to this world, wedded to the things that are here, and only thinking in terms of that, and then all of the evil that comes from that. So the list of the works of the flesh in verse 19 of chapter 5 of Galatians says, now the works of the flesh are evident, sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, and we studied all of those. Of course, they all relate to sexual sins. And then he begins verse 20 with idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, so forth. So our fourth one and what we'll be studying tonight is idolatry. Now, we may think that's sort of odd. We think in terms of having a carved image, like sort of in the background. I can't tell if you can see the bull. I can see it on my screen. It's kind of faded in the back. We're thinking of the golden calves that were set up in Dan and Bethel and that type of thing. A physical image, bowing down to it and it representing some god or goddess somewhere and worshiping in that way. But as we'll get into it and define what idolatry is, it's a concept. I mean, it's capable. We're capable of having idols today. In fact, if you think about it, we use the term like that in some ways. Okay, so the Greek word that's used here is idolatreia. And if you took off the latreia part, you see idol. Do you see that? E-I-D-O-L. We just borrowed the word from the Greeks and made it into an English word. In fact, idolatry almost looks, you know, you're leaving a few letters out, but it has the same sound almost. And almost all versions, both old and new, translated idolatry. Only found a couple that were just a little bit different. They worship idols, or they worshiping gods, New Century Version. So it's a compound word. The first part comes from eidolon, and you can see how if you drop the O-N on that, you see our word idol. And it's used 11 times in the New Testament. Of course, used a number of times in the Old Testament. And then the second word, latreia, means minister to God, worship, or pay homage. And the noun form of it is translated idolatry. It's used seven times. So not a lot in the New Testament, but again, the concept we see several times. Thayer, for instance, defines it, when you look it up in his lexicon, the worship of false gods. The Roman world was full, it says, of idolatry. So James, would you look up Acts 17, verse 16 and 23? And then, Jonathan, would you read Acts 19, verses 24 through 28? So whenever you get there, James. All right, so at verse 16, when Paul was waiting for them at Athens, remember Athens is their central city of the Greek states, more important than probably most all the rest of them, his spirit was provoked within him, but he saw a city full of idols, is the way mine translates it. Again, if you think about some of the ancient places, and the number of idols to all kinds of gods. That's why he says in verse 23, that to the unknown God, in case they forgot one, then they labeled it to the unknown God. And so Paul takes off from that to preach to them about the true and living God. And then in chapter 19, Jonathan, verse 24 to 28.
Brought no small profit to the craftsman. He called
And if you're using a version like the English Standard, Diana is the Greek. Is that the Roman or the Greek name? I think the Greek. Artemis is the counterpart to that. And there was a huge temple to her at Ephesus. There's almost nothing of it exists today. But it was served for, as we'll see, that goes along with idolatry in the New Testament. A lot of illicit practices. A lot of times prostitutes served the temple of a lot of these gods. The Old Testament was the same way. Where we'll talk more about why they thought in terms of that, but they would worship the god by their involvement with a prostitute, and we can't even comprehend that as we think about the true God and what he demands of us, think of the immorality of it, but that would have been very common in Corinth and Ephesus, wherever Paul went. Sometimes when you think the world is bad, I just kind of want you to comprehend what it was like for just a few Christians to begin to go out into a world like this. And sometimes we get all upset about the way things are now. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be upset, but I'm just saying, put it in perspective. There have been a lot of worse places and times. And we may have things that cause us to be upset, but Paul and them were very few when you think about as they started out. Art and Gingrich defines it, idolatry, and then it says, commit unlawful deeds connected with idolatry. And we'll look at that a little more in 1 Peter 4:3 in a minute. So those are the definitions that you'll find for idolatry. So what is the first and basic error of idolatry? I mean, what is it that makes that so wrong that Paul would list it after he talks about all the sexual sins and it becomes the first one he lists? Puts God second. It's just not putting things in their right order or perspective. The worship of a created thing rather than the worship of the Creator of all things. What did God command them back in the Ten Commandments? Do you remember? The very first command said, you shall have no other gods before me. I mean, he'll take second place to no one. Not any other kind of... And then he also commanded them they could not do what? In those first few commandments about himself. Nor make any, what? Graven image or of any likeness of what? What does he say? Fish. You know, he talks about different creatures. Because again, there's nothing here that can fully represent who he is. There's no way to say this equals him. There's nothing here. And once we do that, once you've, you know, brought him down, put him in that box, now you diminished him. And you've made him something other than what he is. So let's think about that in some of the passages. Wes, do you mind reading Romans 1, verse 18 through 25? And then Cole, would you look at 1 Thessalonians 1, verse 9? And Wes, whenever you get there. Yes, please. So that section is really a section that goes together, and it describes to us every epoch of time. It doesn't matter about it being thinking in terms of someone carving an image like a four-footed beast or a bird or even a mortal man. But this is the same problem today. So if you back up with me and just think about it. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all kinds of ungodliness and unrighteousness of men that try to suppress the truth. There is such a thing as the truth. And that at the very beginning of the philosophy that we live in now is there's no such thing as an absolute truth. There's no such thing as that is true and another thing is a lie. And the Bible from the very beginning tells us that's a lie. There is such a thing as absolute truth. There's such a thing as that is. It is this way. This either we believe in God or we don't. And I'm going to tell you, you're going to be on the wrong side of one of those. And if I'm wrong about there being a God, at the end of it all, it's just going to mean I lived a better life than a lot of people. And maybe counted miserable because I didn't enjoy some of the stuff here that they all partake in. But if it's the truth, the other side is going to suffer eternally. A separation that nobody wants to have because of the way he describes hell. And it's either so or it's not. It's true or it's false. And he begins with that thought that they want to suppress the thing that is true because I'm reading a book right now to just give you an idea about human nature. And it's about the codfish and how important cod was in the history of the world. We've almost fished them to extinction. These mighty trawlers that can, you know, just pull just unbelievable nets. And that now you know when you go get fish, you might remember eating cod sometimes back, but that's not what we eat now. You know, if you get fish, it has a bit of brown in it because they're getting other kinds of fish, not the beautiful white. And there's a chapter in the book where it says nobody wanted to believe the truth, and he was talking about all the things that everybody was trying to tell them. Science was trying to tell them, you better stop doing this because we're going to get to a point where the big ones don't. There's not enough big ones to catch up. And I thought it was just fascinating how our nature is to believe the lie, to go toward the thing that is wrong. And I'm not saying we're built that way. I'm just saying that we have the proclivity to deal with any little kid for any length of time or anybody else. And you can see that sort of attitude. For what can be known about God, verse 19, is plain to them. Now, you think about that. That's saying to people today, you ought to know there is a God. It should be plain. Because God has shown it to them. And here's how he did it. For his invisible attributes, the fact that you can't see him, you don't know by touch or sight or hearing him speak, except through, of course, his written word, but I'm talking about hearing with our physical ear, that as we do other people, as we do other persons. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly shown. I mean, he leaves no doubt. We either are going to accept this or not. We either think it's full of malarkey or it's the truth. And he says to us, the truth is, his invisible attributes, he's clearly. There's no murkiness. There's no muddy waters. He's clearly shown ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. A profound argument that's made in this chapter has been true since the beginning of time. And it doesn't matter how fancy society gets, how technologically advanced, how far down the road we are, that same truth is still here. Because there's not a person here that can create a honeybee in all its complexity, in all its ability. You realize they try to make honey. And nobody succeeded. Nobody. They can't duplicate what the honeybee does. And when you stop to think about that, the complexity of the mechanism that just a honeybee has, I think I've told you before about when they go to a flower that's distant from them, they have wings on both sides, but there's four wings. There's two sets of wings. And they have little tiny hooks and little tiny eyelets. Down one wing, there are the eyelets. Down the other wing, there are the hooks. And when they get far away and they're loaded down with nectar, they're too heavy to get back to the hive. The four wings allow them to do that hovering thing that they do, moving from flower to flower. But when they come back, they're just like a 747 loaded down or whatever those big C airplanes are, load them down with unbelievable weight. Sometimes their wings look like they're dipping. But they have the capacity to carry great weight. And you just stop and think about what we'll talk about in a minute, what evolution tries to argue is that the hook and the eyelet just happened. They just with time happened. And the complexity of how it's made is like saying, I've got all these parts to make a pocket watch, and we just throw it up in the air and let it all come down, and it assembles itself exactly the way it's going to make an exact timepiece. And nobody believes that. I mean, you think about the incredible machines that that Brother Ken worked on when he was in NASA. Incredible complexity. And there's nobody here would argue there's no creator to that. It takes mind. It takes thought. It takes ability to engineer. And you look in the world, and I'm going to tell you, that's what he's arguing. So that when you stand before him in the day of judgment, and you say, I did not believe in him, he's just going to read you this. He's going to recite to you what he said here. You had it shown to you clearly to know that there is an eternal God, more powerful than we can possibly imagine. Can't even comprehend what he's capable of doing. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, birds, animals, creeping things. Now, that's what they did in the past. What we're going to talk about in a minute is that's what they do with ideas. Because ideas really are what's behind all of that. If I want a God that says it's okay to have a sexual union with somebody I'm not married to, and that's how I worship the God, that appeals to a bad nature in me. That appeals to me pretty fast. Appeals to you. If that's, you know, we want to go that base route in life. But a God that says I have to be holy and keep myself from sexual impurity and give myself to only one woman for the rest of, from the day I marry her to the rest of my life, and no matter what happens in our marriage, that he doesn't give me an out to go escape and go here and there and shack up with whoever I want to, I'm going to tell you, there's a God that demands something that goes contrary to the three things that we started out with, right? The sexual immorality, the sensuality, and the impurity. That's the world around us. But this God demands something that is like him. He demands of us to be like him. And that's never going to be in animals and the way they behave, and that's why man wants to go that route. We deny the truth like the codfish, and it's not happening. And we do the same thing. All right, Cole, 1 Thessalonians 1 and verse 9. Now you turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God. So again, that it's either this way or it's not. It's either that there is one true living God, living, not something that we've made up, and that he exists definitely apart from us. And so what he'll do in Romans then, to go back to that passage, is then he says, therefore. On the basis of what we just talked about in verses 18 through 23, therefore, because men have done that, he gave them up to the lust of their hearts, to impurity. That's our word that we looked at in the first three of this passage. To the dishonoring of their own bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. And then he just goes through that list of terrible things, including the unnatural relationships between men and men and women, to every other kind of thing you can talk about. He just goes through a litany of them like the works of the flesh. And he connects it directly to how you reason about God, how you reason about whether there is a true and living God or not. The result of that is you either will live one kind of life or you go and live another. And that's exactly what we see in our world. You know, the unraveling of what used to be Judeo-Christian values that predominated maybe predominate is not the right word, but it held a huge sway in our country, and no longer so. So it, we're not going to bow down. Nobody's making, you know, these animal idols or idols of fish and other creatures and bowing down to them. But thinking about that, what are some examples of this kind of thing in our culture today? If we exchange the truth of God, you're going to fill your life with something. You know, nobody really lives for nothing. I mean, at the end of the day, we live for something. So what do we fill it with? What are things that become like idols to us? Well, sports. You think about how it just becomes a predominant thing, you know, in our lives. Good thing. Sports is not a bad thing. Exercising the body, doing, you know, the fun of what most of the time, it's one of the things you can watch on TV because you're not having to view a lot. I mean, besides maybe the scantily clad cheerleaders, besides, you know, maybe sometimes people cussing and things like that, it's a good thing to watch. I mean, it's an enjoyable thing to be a part of. But what happens with us is it becomes everything. That's the thing about idols. You fill your life with the thing that matters. And some people make it everything. Who was telling me about, somebody here was telling me a story about somebody that died, and the only thing they could say at his funeral, I think it was, is that he was a Cowboys fan. And I mean, they went through and talked about how big a Cowboy fan he was. Somebody told me that story here. And they made the point, can you imagine, that that's all you could say about somebody when they've died and gone on. Yeah, it was somebody here, and it was just really very obvious of that illustration. What else, maybe? Other things? Yeah, money. We're gonna get there. I won't talk about it right now, but money becomes a huge thing, right? That can take our full life. Yeah, all right. Knowledge, that the things you could discover. I'm sure Ken could talk about to us of that, of people that he worked with, is it didn't lead them to God. You know, sometimes it didn't lead them to God, but yet they're very smart men or women, very intelligent. But it didn't lead them, you know, to the step beyond that. That's a good point. What'd you call you? Right. Yeah, you know, I think about Hugh Hefner just dying here recently, and I think about what that was like to cross over for him. You know, just you live your life for nothing but the abuse of women. You know, it's incredible to me that there's anybody who defends that. But I can remember how he'd come on talk shows, and everybody thought he's wonderful, and bring men in. And now they're, you know, they're about to expose him. With you know, A&E, I mean, that's usually what happens after they die. Now they expose them. But y'all remember all the stuff that just recently happened, you know, with, I don't remember that, some of these guys that are Hollywood moguls, you know, and just some of the stuff that's happened in the news in the past year or so. Yeah, Ross.
I'm just going to say, you know, Chuck, the thing of it is, you think about Hugh Hefner, that's a godless man.
Yeah.
But you think about Solomon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody can hit us up with the head with a 2x4, and we continue practicing something and putting God second and argue that it's okay to do it.
Yeah.
So that would be the very definition, I think, of what Paul's explaining.
Right.
Those people were guilty of in Romans 1. It's what Solomon even viewed himself as doing.
Yeah. That's a good point. How many times the Bible says, do not be deceived? Do not be deceived. Well, I thought about Darwinian evolution. I thought about how, you know, it just amazes me. Sometimes I'll read a book, and even read one right now, and the guy, you can tell, is a advocate of Darwinian evolution. It's a philosophy of life. It's either God is the eternal God that created it from nothing, or matter is eternal and it somehow formed itself into every complex thing that we see in our world. I mean, it's just, that's how basic you just in words can boil it down to. It's one or the other. It's either mind, there was an unbelievable mind that formed all of this that we see, or it just happened by chance. And even if you, there's no way you can apply, you say this is science, because science has to be observable, it has to be repeatable, you have to be able to come up with hypotheses and then develop those with experiments and show that things happen the same way each time, and you can't do that with Darwinian evolution. It's a philosophy. I look at the world the same world they look at, and this is the best explanation they can give. But when you ask them, how did life get here? How did life get here? There is no answer. You need to watch some of the videos that are out now, just YouTube, just the very idea of what I'm talking about, and you'll run across some really interesting debates that happen between guys that are fully atheists and others that are believers in the one true and living God. And just listen critically. I mean, try to think critically about what they're giving, the best answer they're giving to it. Madeline Murray O'Hara was a great atheist in my day. She's been dead now for a long time. Do y'all remember her, those of you that are old or my age? Nothing exists, she said, but natural phenomenon. There are no supernatural forces, no supernatural entities such as gods or heavens or hells or life after death. We atheists believe that nature simply exists. Matter is, material is. And she was an outspoken member. She was the darling of the media in my day. Everybody would always talk to her. And you remember that she fought the Supreme Court, I think. And she was the one that, I think it was prayer, wasn't it? That the first idea of you can't pray in school. She took her son, and that court case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And so she became. And I'm always, it just always have amazed me when she says there are no supernatural, no gods nor heaven or hell. Here is a physical person confined so finitely to this world telling us that she knows there's none of that. And you're like going, how do you know? The atom wasn't seen forever and ever. I don't know if you can say, I've seen some people think they've caught a vision of electron under an electron microscope. I'm just saying that we know it exists, but for centuries and centuries, nobody knew. And to say it didn't, that doesn't make it not. And it's, again, it's philosophy. It's asking yourself, okay, does it make more sense to believe material has always been, that it's eternal? And that's what I mean by we make an idol. We make that becomes the most important thing to us, and that's what defines us, and that's how we live. J.L. Mackey, a prominent atheist, I myself find it hard to accept the notion of self-creation from nothing, even given unrestricted chance. And you've seen that before in some of the things. You just roll the dice enough, and the millions of times that finally it could come about. But the ones that are more introspective about that, when you catch these quotes, you'll see them occasionally, that they're just being honest. And that's what he's doing. He says, how can this be given if there really is nothing? There's not enough chance you can roll if there truly is nothing, that something could come from nothing. And Anthony Kennedy, of course, famous Oxford University, I believe he was a I forgot what his science was now. Was it in astronomy? Do you remember Ken? You've seen him? I think it was. He was something in that area. Anyway, he said, a proponent of the Big Bang Theory, at least if he is an atheist, must believe that the universe came from nothing and by nothing. It's just asking yourself logically, where did it start? How did it start? Why did it start? And it just boggles our mind, if we think of it. I think about the green movement, by that I mean that we worship the earth as mother. And it makes sense. If you don't believe in eternal living God, then what becomes all important? Now, I'm all for treating the earth. I recycle, okay? So I do my part. as I can. I probably leave a carbon footstep bigger than some people would like. But at the end of the day, the Bible tells us a whole different story about what's going to happen to this place, right? That one day it's going to, the earth and all that are in it, the works, are going to be burned up with fire. That God's coming, not with a flood as he did back eons ago, but he's coming this time to burn it all up. And that it will be a great noise and the elements will melt with fervent heat. And of course, the reason I believe that is because I go back to the evidence for the resurrection. I go back to the evidence for there being a creator that Paul talks about in Romans 1. I can't see all of that. I know it by faith, but listen to me. An evolutionist, a Darwinian evolutionist, believes what he believes by faith too. Because he doesn't have the experiments to prove his theory. He believes it by faith, just like I do. Now, who has the better evidence behind them? That's the thing we're asking to point us toward the thing we ought to attach our life to. Because you know as I know, there are people that have attached their life. Their idol is this world and all of that. Secular humanism became, with the rise of the Enlightenment and the downplaying of God and thinking science could answer everything, out of that grew secular humanism where man becomes the center, but it's always been that way, right? Has always been that in whatever we talk about. So William Barclay goes on to talk about this in his book Flesh and Spirit. He said, a man's God may rightly be said to be that to which he dedicates his time, his substance, and his talents, that to which he gives himself. I was thinking when I was reading his quote, I was thinking about Romans 6, verse 16, where Paul says, do you not know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. So that Paul's saying that we have two choices in life. There are just two. You either lead a life toward righteousness, and that is God, or we lead a life towards sin, and I want you to get at what he says, both of us are slaves. It doesn't matter which side you're talking about. We're both slaves. In other words, a man doesn't exist. I don't exist eternally. I don't exist. I'm gonna expire pretty fast. I'm on the downside of things as far as my age. It's amazing how you look at your life and you realize how quickly it has passed. And we're gonna slip into, you know, if the evolution is right, we're gonna slip into oblivion and that's it. But you give yourself to something. All of us give ourselves to something. And Paul talks about it in terms of being a slave. We're either the slave of righteousness or we're the slave of sin. And we obey one or the other. He goes on to say, whenever anything in the world begins to hold the principal place in our hearts and minds and aims, then that thing has become an idol. For that thing has usurped the place which belongs to God. And Edward Curtis says in the Anchor Bible Dictionary, the New Testament also understands idolatry as putting anything in the place that God alone should occupy as the proper focus of obedience and worship. And that's a passage of Colossians 3:5 that says, covetousness, which is idolatry. And so he speaks of covetousness that way. So when I think about that, when I think about loving money, now covetousness there may mean what we said earlier because it's in a context of sexual sin, and you can definitely see somebody like Hugh Hefner, those kind of people that they just live for that, you know, that coveted. So it may be right, but covetousness is a large word, isn't it? And so I'm going to take it here to mean money. Why is covetousness of money a form of idolatry? What makes the love of money become like idolatry? You think? Okay. You think it's an end all and be all of things, that we find happiness that way. Have you ever met, I'm not saying they don't exist, but have you ever met somebody that's really rich? Have you ever met them? Have you watched their families? Have you looked at their families? There's a friend of mine that is friends with the Books A Million family. Do you know the Books A Million stores? They're in Florence, Alabama, and she babysitted for them. She's a really fine young lady, a Christian, and they love her. And she would, the guy would call up his They would fly to San Francisco, and he'd call up his yacht that was anchored somewhere in Alabama, and it would sail through the Panama Canal and come all the way over there to San Francisco and pick them up. And she would board it with them, and then they'd go sailing places. I mean, just money that you cannot imagine. I mean, none of us can imagine that kind of lifestyle. You know, I've read some of the stories about people that they get on a plane, fly with 20, 30 of them to Italy, eat a night out in a humongous restaurant, and fly back home. And the kind of money they spend to them is nothing. And with me, it's like, you know, 10 years' wages in one single night. So we don't even live in the same world. We don't operate in the same world. But what is true most of the time when you read about these families is they are a mess. And she witnessed it firsthand, how just they can't get along with each other. They hate one another. They behave in terrible ways. And generally speaking, I'm not saying there's an exceptions to it, but generally speaking, that's what happens with what we do if it's not that we fill this void in us with God that's shaped like God, and we try to fill it with something else. You know, remember the rich young ruler? I mean, there's a guy that, a minute ago, what Ross said, who wanted God. Here's a guy that wants God. And he comes to him and he says, I've kept all the commandments. I've done it. And Jesus says to him, what? One thing you lack. And he puts before him the thing that tells you what his idol is. Go sell all that you have. Now, he's not telling all of us to do that. Remember, later Timothy will say, if you're rich, share what you have. Okay? Paul didn't tell them, sell everything you have. But this guy, Jesus saw right to his heart, and he said, you go sell everything you have, give to the poor, and come follow me. And what was his reaction? He went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. And he told you whose idol is. He couldn't let go of the stuff. And he went to his grave with the stuff, and he took not one ounce of it with him. And I can't imagine what happened to him. I hope he came to his senses, but I doubt it, you know, if he had that great moment to decide. We lose our humility to trust only in God, what you were saying, Cole, and serve God's purposes. You know, remind those that are rich in this present world to not set their what? Trust in what kind of riches? Anybody in the stock market right now? I'm in the stock market. I heard Larry the other day at breakfast say, you know, I mean, if we have IRAs or things like that, he said, I looked at my IRA and it's $12,000 less than it was. And he said, a guy on a fixed income, that's a hurt. Well, I have a little more time on my side, but I understand that. If I put my trust in what? Uncertain riches. Because we may think, I mean, right now you're living nice and you may be in retirement, everything going well. Man, you better always think about that. Uncertain. Because it could all be gone like that. And we need to remember that. Be grateful, but put your trust in God. Okay, that's about where I wanted to be. Spend it on our selfish pleasure. I mean, those are the kinds of things. And there are other things like that. Can we love people that way? Could you love your mate? And they become like an idol, you know. And it could be a lot of things. We could think about politics, and there's just a lot of different avenues to take. Okay, thanks for your help in the class.